Hey, you guys. That's lame. Hey, you guys. Yeah, it's good to be back. It's been a year, and how many have been here? Well, you were here last year. Let me just see your hands. Just raise, wave, whatever, throw something. Good, 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 good. I look forward to coming down here because this is just a great environment for Christian teaching, to grow strong Christians. And I love Hughes Auditorium. I mean, this is a cool place, right? I'm at different universities from time to time, but there is no place like Hughes where you stand in here and you look up and you see stained glass window right over your head. And then you hear, "Take a ride on my big green tractor." I sort of like putting those two together and I couldn't get that to work. But that was a great song. I don't like country music. Sorry about that. Really, it's country music and opera, both of those things. But you guys did a great job. Where is this band? You did a great job. I mean, you guys started out and hit it hard, didn't they? Come on. Give it up. They guys hit it hard. So it's fun. It's fun to get to be here and to talk to you about things that I love to talk about. Hopefully sometime in the next 2.5 days, I can get you interested in a little bit of that. Because you guys, this stuff is changing my life. It's what God's doing in my life lately that's so important to me. We talked, I guess the way to start is just to say, come right out and tell you the premise for the week. And that is that I believe God is trying to get us ready for another world. I mean, imagine for a moment that there's an alternate reality. I've said this a few years ago while I was here. Imagine that there's an alternate reality that is right next to your head. Imagine to die is not to go up, but to go over. It's to slip into another dimension, another realm of being that you cannot see because it's invisible to people who are living in this set of physics. Does that make sense? But that may be what heaven is. It is closer than your breath. And the trouble is that when you and I were born into this world, we were born in a state of mind where we like it here. And everything about this world teaches us to like it here. We have our own set of values. Whole different set of things is important to us. But what I'm learning in my church is that when people die, and we've had 12 deaths in the last 20 days in my church. So it's like we preach Sunday sermons and we do a couple funerals during the week. And what I'm learning is that when Christians or even non-Christians die, they slip over into another reality. And when they get there, you guys, it's a whole different set of rules. All of a sudden, the real rock stars over there are people who bring peace. It's people who are meek. It's people that you'd consider weak and timid and low self-esteem. When they get there, it's going to be everything that we know standing on its head. You're not measured by the money you make. You're measured by the money you give away. Over there, the most powerful person in the room gets down and washes people's feet. And over there, children and being childlike, not growing up, acting your age, be mature, none of that. It's the child over there that is the real hero of the day. So you see, what strikes me is that we're actually learning over here how to live one way, but when we get over there, it's going to be an entirely different way. And what I'm trying to learn before I go, and I'm older than I used to be, before I go, I'm trying to learn to get that now, man. I don't want that sudden shift. I mean, I don't want to show up in heaven one day and say, "Wow, man, I hate this place." You know, if you love money on your last day on earth, why would you not love it there? If you power up and if you're critical of people here on the day you die, why would you suddenly be perfect over there? So you might find yourself in a culture that you don't even like. But then you think, well, what are the options? So it's almost like going to another land and you don't like the food. You have to learn to like it, or you got to leave. And so how do we do that? That, right there, that is the process of being transformed. That's what's capturing my imagination lately, is what does it mean to be transformed? Does it mean that we're going to live according to a certain pre-established set of rules and expectations? No, to be transformed simply means to be rewired from the inside so that everything about me, my imaginations, my dreams, my personality, my tastes, my default, my assumptions, my values, the way that I talk and the way I respond, all of that is suddenly ready for another world. Because I am already headed there at unnerving speed. That makes sense? C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, tells how Lucy steps into the cabinet. Have you seen the movie, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe? Yeah. If you read the book, it's a little bit better. And there's a scene where Lucy goes and hides inside the cabinet, right? And she rifles past the coats and she wants to hide in back. But as she gets in the back of the cabinet, she actually falls out of the cabinet and she falls into a whole new world known as Narnia. You did see the movie. Well, then the way the book says, she's in the back and all of a sudden she feels the prickly of like evergreen on her cheek. And she wonders are they like hiding trees inside of the cabinet? And she realizes she's in another world. And this is a strange world indeed. It's a world where like you're half animal, half beast, right? You have the head of an animal, but you talk. Beavers make supper. You know, and you're like, what? I mean, who does this? Well, it's common over there. So I'm asking myself, how do we go through that transformation process? Because we're clearly leaving this world, which we consider the only reality, and how do we get it into that one? That is the process of transformation. And for that, there are a few passages, but one I want to read this morning comes from 2 Corinthians chapter 3. We have such a hope. And so we are bold. We are not like Moses, he said, who put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. Listen, their minds were made dull. For to this day, the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It's not been removed because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day when Moses, that's when the Old Testament is read, a veil, if you want, read just kind of a gloss, covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, we are being transformed, there's the word, into his likeness with an ever-increasing glory which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. There's two parts to the transformation process. And I think what's happening is we get messed up. We get stuck on one of these things. Imagine that this is the thing that we're supposed to be transformed to. And you and I are born. I'll go over here. You and I are born a long ways away from that thing. That's the image. This is the image of Jesus Christ. Okay. It's thinking, acting, responding just like Jesus. Well, the problem is we were born a long way from that. And not only that, but we were born with our backs to it. Now, what I think I heard him say was, when anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. But then he goes on to say in verse 18 that we who have turned to the Lord are being transformed with an ever increasing glory which comes from the Lord. So those are the two parts. Those are the two parts of transformation. One is the actual turning, like this. This we call sometimes salvation. We sometimes call it conversion. It's not conversion, but we call it that. It's in theology, they call it justification. It's just because theologians find hard ways to say everything. And all that means is it's what Peter Marshall called a tap on the shoulder. You're headed one way, somebody taps you on the shoulder, you turn around, it seizes your attention. For some people, this is a baptism, believe it or not. They are genuinely turned at baptism. I know a gal who in the Catholic Church walked into the baptismal place, the waters, a little pool on the chancel of the Catholic Church. And she said, "Steve, I don't know what everyone else felt that day, but my catechism was preparing me for a moment. I did not know what. But when I got into the pool," she said, "I went down on my knees, and as they poured the water over my head, I came off of my knees. And as I looked up," she said, "it was almost as if the sun was coming through the top, and I knew that God met me there. And in that moment, everything was different for me. Something switched." Does that make sense? Some people get that at an altar. Some people get it driving in their car. They pull over to the side of the road. They'll get in a wreck. And I mean, they're just overcome. C.S. Lewis said, "I found myself getting in the car, driving across town, and on the other side of town, I don't know how, I started believing things I thought unthinkable just a few moments ago." There's a guy who's in prison. He's out now. He was in prison for child molestation. And the pastor goes in to pray with him. And he's a hard kind of agnostic guy. Doesn't matter if there's a God or not. There's bigger things to worry about. Think about that. Bigger things that, yeah, okay. And while they're talking, the pastor says, "I'm getting nowhere." And all of a sudden the pastor just says, "Okay, you know, Bob, do you mind if I just pray?" "Yeah, go ahead, pray." So the pastor gets down and he starts to pray next to Bob. And all of a sudden Bob is just got his eyes shut and he says, "Amen." And the pastor gets up to leave and Bob says, "Wait a second. I don't know what this is, but half of me right now is starting to think that you might be right." Now, where does that come from? I mean, how do you make a 180 in so short a time? It's like turning water into wine. Somebody should do that sometime. You know, I mean, it's that big of a deal. All of a sudden, the impossible is possible. You're healed. Luke says you're healed. You are saved. You're brought back from the dead in a spiritual sense. And the problem is that as a pastor, and I know, Greg, you must feel this way, we sometimes are called to disciple people and they've never had this moment yet. Man, it feels like we're trying to disciple the dead. Bury that sucker. Don't disciple him, right? Wait till he comes alive. I mean, I'm talking to some dude who's now saved and he says he wants to be discipled. And everything I'm ticking off, well, here's some of the things that Jesus said we should do. He's going, "Oh man, that's a bummer. No, that's a drag." I'm like, "Dude, you cannot be saved today. Have a good life." Right? Because I can't do that. That's a miracle. And if that has never happened to you yet, no one's down on you, no one's saying, "Come on down and do it now." Yeah, you can't do that. You can't do that until God starts to prompt you by his Spirit. "Whosoever will may come, but not whenever they want." You have to be drawn by God. God first, then you. Does that make sense? Just go, "Uh-huh." Oh, good. Because I was out of ways to explain that. That's the first part. It's that sudden turn. Then the second part is this transformation process. This is, once we turn, it's this process of gradually being conformed. That means we are gradually getting more and more and more like Jesus. Here's the problem. When I was a kid, we emphasized this and we quit. And so what happens is we got Christians who would say what we called a sinner's prayer, and then they would turn, and then nothing happened after that. Have you ever seen them? In my days, getting people saved or hear this, preaching a sermon and measuring the sermon by how many people got saved was a big deal. I mean, I grew up listening to preachers say, oh, yeah, the altar was lined. Well, of course, people today are going, huh? Why were they on the altar? They have no idea. But you see, back then, everything, I mean everything, was about getting people to make an initial decision. Have you become a Christian? Yes. Did you say the prayer? Yes. Did you get baptized? Yes. You signed the card? Yes. Have you been entirely sanctified? Yes. See it? But the problem was, they were still mean. I mean the sanctified people. They were so holy that they hated unholy people. They didn't like children. You know, I had one in the church who said, oh my word, these people are hard for me to deal with. She's Christian rock is an oxymoron. Oh, stop. You know, it's that. It's this kind of, I did what you asked me to do. I came to the altar. I consecrated my life. I'm a sanctified person. The question that everyone wants to know is, then how come you ain't easier to live with? This generation is making the other mistake. This generation, and I'm talking about the modern writers right now. I'm talking about, you know, about the Brian McLarens and the Dan Kimballs and the Rob Bells and whoever else that you guys read. They're making the opposite mistake of saying, hey, just get into the Jesus narrative. Live the Jesus story. Take up his life. And they're asking you to become more and more like him. But what they're soft on is that turning moment. You know, it's that miracle. If you do this and stop, then you are a useless Christian. If in fact you are Christian at all. But if you do this and you never turn, you're a humanist. You somehow believe that you can, on your own power and authority, decide to live Jesus' story and that you can get it right. Look, read the Sermon on the Mount. These things are not difficult. They're impossible. You know, something has to happen to us or else we... So I'm asking myself, what are the changes that have to take place in our heart? And this is where God's taking me, and I'm going to finish this for the next couple of days. These are what I'm calling soul shifts. They're soul shifts. As best as I can tell, the transformation process, you guys, it begins in a soul. It does not begin on the active level. It's you could be praying a prayer or you could not. You could be in church or you could be anywhere. Transformation happens when all of a sudden something deep inside of you begins to change. I call them soul shifts because it's almost like the tectonic plates that are underneath the earth's surface. Well, according to geologists, they're always moving like this a little bit, and you never know it. Like right now, they're moving and you don't care. But every now and then, as we've learned in Haiti twice in the last couple of weeks, every now and then there will be a major shift. It'll go poof. And when it does, everything on the surface is altered from better to worse. When those fault lines go like this, even though you can't see them, suddenly you care. And people start running for cover. In California, they call them rollers. And it's this sense literally at which the ground is coming towards you and it's rolling like there's something under the carpet and it's just going, you know, where do you run? What do? You have no control over that. But all of a sudden you care about geology because your life is about to change. Think of spiritual formation as happening that way deep inside of you. No, that's not right. You are a soul.
You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body. And your soul is, it's your imaginations, and it's your assumptions, it's your desires, it's your personality, it's the stuff that you really want. I mean, it's the stuff that's important to you. It's why you listen to some things and find them interesting and you find others boring. It's why you laugh at certain things and you don't laugh at other things. The state of your soul determines what you want to be. It's your dreams, and even more, it's why you dream that. Now, I'm not saying that your soul is nothing more than the sum of all these things. I'm saying your soul is underneath all of these things. Genesis says, it is every inclination of the thought of the heart. There, you didn't even know hearts had thoughts, did you? But they do, and thoughts have inclinations. I mean, this baby goes deep, and it determines literally everything about you. And so don't think of your soul as this thing inside of you that just waits to pop out when you die. Your soul is already wrapped all around your being. It's why some people who aren't that attractive are attractive. It's what you call chemistry, because there's more to somebody than just what you see. See, you like them or you don't, in part because of the state of the soul. And here's the big news. You is one. Really, even if you doubt it, it's true. And here's the other thing. You can never go there. You cannot know the state of your soul. Unless somebody shows you. You can't get into a room and say, well, let's think about me. Because it does no good. Because you see, part of having a bad soul is that you lie to yourself. You know? And so even when you think about yourself, you will not tell yourself the truth. This is why the psalmist says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and see if there be any wicked ways in me. Lead me in the way of life everlasting. One of the mistakes that we've made in recent evangelism, in my opinion, is that we've pretended to tell people the state of their souls when we do not know it, nor do they. It takes a moment, and it's often not the moment you're looking for. It's another moment. A very ugly woman gets on a train. She is in a foreign country. Two American teenagers are sitting on the bench, and they are watching her hobble across and find her seat and sit down. One of the teenagers looks at the old woman and starts to make some comments. And he says, how ugly and deformed that she is. The other teenager is typical of them. They just start to giggle. And all of a sudden, she becomes the fodder for two kids with low self-esteem who have to find somebody lower on the totem pole. All of a sudden, when the woman, the Russian woman, ugly and overweight, stands up to get off the train. She goes by the two teenage boys and she looks at one of them and she says in perfect English, I'll have you know, I was not always this ugly. That's a moment right there. Now, either we can look at ourselves and say, my goodness, what is it? What is it about me that has to feast off of somebody else's deformities? Or, as is often the case, we can just slough it off. We can say, and make some flippant comment. This is why Alan Jones says, listen to the statement, the soul is aborted 1,000 times a day. What he means is there are opportunities to see it and we don't catch them. We miss them. Because we move on to the next conversation, the next big thing, the next song. We just move. So you can't know it whenever you want. You can know it when God shows it to you. But here's the last part. That soul can shift. You can't control the state of your soul. But here's the good news. You can control things that control your soul. Your soul will become like the temperature in the room, but you have some control over the temperature in the room. And so part of being changed is getting hold of the things that are shaping us. Do you see it? Whether it's music, whether it's movies, it's friends, it's books, it's conversations, it's fleeting thoughts, whatever those things are that we know subtly shape the condition of our soul, we can change those things. And as we do, there will come a day when all of a sudden there will be a shift and you will change from one thing to something else. So for the next three times that I talk to you, I want to talk about three major soul shifts that I think we need at the ripe age of 20 or 22 years old. You know what I mean? I mean, I think if I were your age, these are things I wish somebody would have said. Steve, as you head out into life, you know what? Stop measuring yourself according to how many services you make, according to whether or not you prayed the prayer, according to whether or not you're being discipled, according to whether or not you've had the second work of grace. Steve, quit measuring yourself according to that. Measure yourself according to outcomes. Have these things actually happened in your life? I do not care to hear the books that you've read. I want to see the effect of them, right? You know, I don't care what classes you're in. I don't care what your disciplines are. I want to know that when you get ready to leave this world, you fit. You like it over there. So, Steve, start measuring yourself according to these things. Last story, and then I'll let these guys play. I have a friend who restores classic automobiles. Do you know what I mean? These are the old clunkers kind of thing. And he goes out and he buys, in my opinion, an inflated price for an old beat up, rusty piece of junk. And so I'm at his house not long ago, and he says to me, hey, I got to show you my car, my new toy. I said, what is it? He goes, the 1967 GTO, fire truck red. I said, really? He said, yep, come out to the shed, man. You're going to love this baby. So he walks me across the thing. I'm imagining what this is going to look like. He flings open the door, flips on the lights, and there on the floor in a million pieces is his rusty brown Pontiac GTO 1967. And I thought to myself, how do I say this to this guy? And he just goes, man, look at that. What do you think? What do you think? I went, yeah, that's really something, man. I don't have the words, you know? And he starts walking me around. He shows me all the engine parts. He has them categorized. Engine first, then all this piece over here. And one by one, he holds the pieces up and he goes, and then, you know what this baby does? I'm going, I have no clue. And he's like, he describes the whole thing. I'm thinking, how in your right mind? And then I see it over on the wall. He has a poster of a 1967 Pontiac GTO fire truck red in perfect mint condition. He says, every day I come into this place, he said, I'll pick up a piece and I'll start hitting it hard as I can, knocking off the rust, trying to get it to work. If it doesn't work, I just get a new part. But he said, every day when I come in here, I get so frustrated. And I think, man, why did I waste so much money on this piece of junk? I will look over at that poster and I see what this baby's going to look like when I get it done. You see it? And all of a sudden, it popped for me. I started to realize that God has a poster with you on it of what you looked like before the fall. And every day he goes to work on you, shifting as little as he can. It is not because he is hating you and he's hard on you and he doesn't like you and he's paying you back and he's getting that sin. It's not that at all. It's that God knows what sin does to the classic that you were created to be. And there's not just one kind of classic. There's lots of classics. He would no sooner make you like me than he would try to convert a 67 GTO into a 66 Ford Mustang. It's not just stupid. It won't work. You see it? So God knows what you look like, even if you don't. He sees you in perfect mint condition, and he will not rest. He won't stop until you become that kind of person, until your personality begins to come out, and you become even better than you are now, even if you think you're pretty hot. You become even more better in a humble sort of way. This week, my prayer, if I leave nothing behind, it's the hope in you that God will complete what he started. You know why? Paul said, for this reason I press on, to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. When Jesus took hold of me, there was the poster. And I will press on until it's done. Jesus, now for the next few days, take these thoughts. Give us opportunities, wonderful opportunities, to see ourselves in the transparent love of Jesus. And to deal with what we must, but to change, to become the image of Christ. In your name I pray. Amen.